Welcome in to the Lakers Collective. I'm Trevor Lane, Jovan Buha, Jason Timpf. We're all here to talk some Lakers basketball today. And I don't know about you guys. I just got back from a vacation. And I don't know if it's just not being on the boat anymore or if it's what the Lakers did last night. But I am in a foul mood today, guys.
I felt like that the entire time we were watching that game. That was not fun to watch. I don't know about you guys. There was never a single point in that game where I was like, oh, the Lakers have a shot to win this. I felt like they were thoroughly outclassed in almost every phase of the game.
I liked the start to the game, but a lot of that was just, you know, they had some shot making early, and then as the game started to stabilize, you started to see the increasing gap between the two teams. But we're going to get into it, but it was a very deflating loss, and I think whatever optimism I had left with this group has been close to shattered.
That was the last straw for you.
I'm pretty much there. We could start getting into it, but like they're 8-4 with the big three. But you look at the teams they've beaten with the big three: Clippers twice, Jazz twice, the Sixers twice, the Pelicans and the Nets. So it's not the most encouraging group of teams they've beaten. The teams they've lost to: Spurs, Rockets, Suns, and now Celtics, all by double figures. Like three of those were by 20 plus points. So it's like when they play, and I've whittled it down to moving forward, if the Lakers are playing someone with under a 60% win percentage, I don't care anymore. They're going to beat those teams more often than not. They're going to win like 80% of those games. The 60% win percentage is where the cutoff is. Against those teams this season, they are 4-11. They've not beaten a team at that win percentage with the big three. That they've lost all those games. But they're 4-11 with three of those four wins coming in the first 2 weeks of the season. That was Minnesota twice and San Antonio once. Both of those teams are much better than they were back then. But then you look at the 11 losses, 10 of the 11 have been by double figures. The one loss that wasn't was the OKC loss, which they lost by 9. So right there at the precipice of 10. So it's like when they play a team that is, you know, functionally a top 10 team in the league, they get their ass kicked. When they play the bottom 20 teams, they often win those games, you know, 80, 85% of the time. So there's a real delineation there of when this team plays a good team, they just can't beat them. And it doesn't matter if it's the big three, doesn't matter if it's two of them, doesn't matter if it's one of them, they just can't beat these teams at all. So that it's tough to find the optimism in that, right? Because they're going to play one of these teams in the first round, and I think they will likely be heavy underdogs.
I think when you look at the top 10 teams, the Lakers have the most clear and obvious weaknesses and very attackable weaknesses on both sides of the ball. And that is, again, probably talking about a first, maybe best case, a second round exit. But even then, I think it would be matchup dependent. Jason, one of the things that struck me, too, is when the Lakers are playing these teams, they're losing in different ways in terms of how it's not like it's the same problem every single night. There's, I think, a handful of problems that rear their ugly heads, but they can't seem to check all the boxes that they need to against the best teams.
Yeah, I think there are some recurring things. Like Boston was yet another team that was pressuring the ball full court and running a deep drop coverage and having some success defending just our regular pick and roll attacks. I want to dive a little deeper into that. I just want to quickly double down on Jovan's take about how the Lakers have performed based on their competition. It gets a little darker when you dive into the difference between the lower level teams they've played. So when they play teams in the bottom 10 in point differential, they're 18-2, which is tied with Oklahoma City for the best record in the NBA against those types of teams.
Not a bad thing.
Driving their record. And I mean, before we go any further, that automatically means they're under 500 against everyone else. Mm-hmm. But if you just take that, they're plus 11 point differential in those games, which is pretty solid. That's eighth, but still below what you'd expect for being the best record in that run. The middle 10 in point differential, they're just 11-9, 11th best record in the NBA, a negative 3 point differential in those games. That's 21st in the league. And then 5-11 against the top 10 teams in point differential, negative 13 points per game in those games, which ranks 28th in the NBA. Only the Nets and the Wizards have been worse. There were so many different things about that game last night that frustrated me, because like there's kind of like this big picture dynamic with what I was talking about with the drop coverage, where It's just that the Lakers stars are prone to bad games against that look. And I think the reason why is because none of them are good enough as like reliable three-point shooters to space the floor enough for them to get the types of looks that they need against those dynamics. Austin has been prone to bad games against these smaller, quicker guards that can get up in him. And I didn't like his approach last night against the drop too. I thought he was attacking the big's body too much instead of, there was plenty of opportunity for him to get some work in the mid-range. Credit the Celtics for that. I thought their back pressure was good all night, but whenever they did get some space, there was kind of some forcing it around the basket, some foul grifting instead of looking to make shots that we saw. The gap in just overall seriousness about the margins between the two teams was like shocking. Like,
yeah,
there were so many like little stretches of the game where the Lakers lost control with like basic fundamental stuff that they suck at. So like, for instance, in the late second quarter, and part of this is on JJ, he went with this lineup that was LeBron and Luka, Ayton with Kennard and Rui. And they had two possessions where no one picked up the ball, and Derek White had a driving little floater that he hit, and then Jaylen Brown had a driving layup. And big plays in the game, like big momentum plays for Boston as they built their first double-digit lead. And it was like, well, yeah, you got five dudes on the floor. None of them think they can pick up the ball. Like, Luke Kennard's not going to be thinking, I'm the guy who's stopping ball in transition. LeBron's not going to think that. Luka's not going to think that. Rui's not going to think that. Ayton's not going to think that. That JJ identified it, immediately subbed Austin into the game. But it's like, that was a four-point swing that took place in that stretch because you literally just have a group of guys out there that no one wants to do the most important job in transition defense, which is stop the ball, right? Or like in that third quarter run when Boston went up by like, I think, 15 or so in the middle of third quarter, it was like LeBron and Luka were so bad in their backline defense, like getting back cut or leaving shooters open. Baylor Shireman and Hugo Gonzalez were just killing those guys with just their effort on their corner crashes. And I thought LeBron in general was really inattentive on defense in this game. He had a brutally bad one in the late first half where he left Derek White wide open in the corner on an ISO, where it's just like, he's one pass away, Derek White. You can't be playing 15 feet off of him. Like, what are you doing? Like, there's just a level of seriousness that this Boston team has that the Lakers don't have. And I thought there's the last thing I'll say about it. There's one play in particular from this game that screams off the screen for me. And it was in the first half run. The Celtics are in that stretch where they're getting all their forcing turnovers and scoring in transition. And Luka gets the ball off of an inbound and starts bringing it up in front of the Celtics bench. And he's not getting ball pressured because the Celtics in this possession, they were a little disheveled. No one picked up the ball. And Joe Mazzulla's up like screaming at his guys and pointing at Luka, like, and half the bench is all animated, like, somebody get the ball, someone get the ball. And it's like, this is middle second quarter. You're mid ass whooping against the Lakers. You're playing awesome. There's nothing that's really going against you in the game to this point. You're the 2 seed in the East. You're in rock solid position. It's February 22nd. There's no reason for you guys to care this much about picking Luka up full court in the middle of the second quarter, but you do. You do care because culturally there's this expectation and accountability to their standards of how they expect to win. The Lakers expect to win one way, and that's by being the best half-court offense in the NBA. Here's Luka, LeBron, and Austin. We're going to outscore you in these surgical slowdown half-court environments. Well, what happens when all three of them have a bad game like they did last night? They got nothing else they're good at, not a single damn thing that they're good at. The Celtics, they can have a game where they don't shoot well. They can win with their defense, and they can win with offensive rebounding, and they can win with points off of turnovers. They can win with their offense on some nights. They have a bunch of different ways that they can win. The Lakers have one way they can win, and that's if their stars just carry them on offense. And that is going to leave them susceptible to these types of nights where they just get outclassed in every single margin.
No, I think that's a great point, that there are certain areas where the Lakers have to be great. Otherwise, they're just kind of out of luck. I mean, we look at what the key stats were going into that game. The Celtics have been an extremely low turnover team all season. Back there, number one. I don't know if they are anymore after last night's game, but they were number one in the NBA in turnover percentage. The Lakers actually won that battle, and the Lakers have been a much higher turnover team. It was 14-8. In turnovers. The offensive glass, the Lakers lost by one. The Celtics have the fifth best offensive rebound percentage in the NBA. The areas you would identify in this game that would be problematic for the Lakers largely weren't. Now, you did lose three-pointers made by five, and that certainly hurts, and the Celtics a much higher volume three-point shooting team, but the Lakers lost in ways that we wouldn't necessarily predict coming into this game. They did what they needed to do in some key statistical categories, but I think ultimately, stats aside, it drills down to the Celtics very clearly wanted that game more than the Lakers did. They played harder than the Lakers did. They played with much more intentionality. They played like this was a game that mattered to them, and the Lakers kind of played like they were just out there getting through the 48 minutes, and then they're going to move on with the rest of their lives. And in that way, when James Worthy after the game was talking about disrespecting the uniform, I thought we did see an element of that, and it comes from a cultural place with this team where, hey, this is a big game, and I know no Lakers fans felt secure going into that game, felt good going into that game, because you had a feeling there's a good chance that they were going to do something like what they did last night, which was play very unserious basketball. One stat that I just threw out there on X like 20 minutes ago was they threw nearly 50 less passes against the Celtics than they did the game before against the Clippers. When we saw all this great off-ball stuff that they were throwing in against the Clippers, all of that just completely went away. Like all the stuff that was working that looked good, they were getting Austin Reeves and all these actions off ball, it all just stagnated and they went, nope, we're not going to do that anymore. We're instead just going to go to iso ball, jack up shots, and really not play like we are invested in this game. And Jovan, that's where I see right now most Lakers fans are upset with the way they approach that game. It's maddening. It's mad. Like you said, that for you was the straw that broke the camel's back here. I just don't have faith that this team's going to step up when they need to, because time after time after time in situations where they need to step up, they have outright refused to do so.
And another trend that we've seen with them in some of these matchups against some of the better teams has been, if you can play drop coverage and be in that deep drop and keep it a 2v2 in the Lakers pick and roll attack, you can beat this team and contain their offense. Mm-hmm. And we saw it against the Spurs. We saw it against the Suns. We saw it last night against the Celtics. Like I think they deserve a lot of credit. Like they held the big three to combine 41% shooting, which if those three are combining for 60 points on 41% shooting, they're not going to beat any good team with those numbers. But like just drop coverage defense and their ability to not die on the screen, the ability to rear view contest, the ability to force, like Luka shot 5 for 15 on twos last night. I thought he got a bunch of good looks, just didn't make them at the rate that he typically does. But a lot of that has to be credit to the Celtics and their discipline in the pick and roll and drop and just the spots that they were forcing the Lakers offense to shift to. And so I think you look at that, but then you also look at like Luke Kennard hit a couple shots in garbage time after the Lakers cleared out the closers. But through the first 44 minutes of this game, through the first competitive portion, we will generously say no Laker outside the big three had more than 5 points. And like, so it was like the big three were not up to their normal standards in terms of their efficiency and their overall offensive production. And LeBron had 5 assists, which led the big three and led the team. And like, those guys all should be in that like 6 to 8 assist range at a minimum. But like that aside, no one else did anything offensively. DeAndre Ayton, another no-show performance from him. He kind of had to play because Jackson Hayes got injured, but another really like Nemias Keita is just a better version of DeAndre Ayton at this point, right? Like they're very similar players in terms of like how they're used. He's outplayed him in both of the Boston games so far, and I think he's just a better player straight up. Then you had Rui go 2 for 7. You had Marcus go 0 for 7, 0 for 5 on threes. Luke Kennard is out there taking 1-3 in the competitive portion of the game or 2 maybe. He's not getting looks. It's just like, even if the big three were great last night, I don't think they got enough, anywhere close to enough from the supporting cast. And like, that's been another thing here of I think the best version of this team is like the big three are crushing it, or at least 2 of the 3 are crushing it. But you also need a certain baseline level from the supporting cast. And unfortunately, I felt like last night was closer to a preview of what we would see in a playoff series where like the Lakers just don't have anywhere close to the supporting talent, similar to the other top 10 teams in the league, where again, we've talked about it before. Like I think the 4th best Laker would be the 9th best player on OKC. Yeah. And that's a problem if they're playing OKC in a playoff series. So like they're just at a talent deficit across the board with the supporting cast. And then the big three have just not been able to put it together yet. And like they have almost a -10 net rating together this season. It's like, they're losing those minutes by a lot. I don't really know what you do other than like continue to beat the average teams, dominate the bad teams, and then lose to the good teams.
I think it speaks to when we look at this Lakers team, this is going to be a problem for the summer. When we talk about, you know, how big the mountain they have to climb this summer is going to be, the reason for it is because when we look at the Lakers' big three, right, LeBron, Luka, and Austin, and they were not good, and we're going to talk all about them in just a moment. But when we look at the rest of the players, what this team is really missing is they're missing players, let's say 4 through 6 or 4 through 7. They're missing those guys. The rest of the team really should be players 7, 8, 9, 10 on the depth chart of a good team, and you have those other key pieces. Finding those types of players, like your 4th best player, 5th best player, finding those types of players this summer is going to be challenging, and it's very noticeable that you're missing those guys when you get into matchups with a team like the Celtics, who can make life difficult on your big three. And they did not play particularly well, even with the Celtics playing well defensively. Then when you don't have those players 4, 5, 6 that you could turn to that can actually step up and do things for you, it really sticks out like a sore thumb. And so that's going to be a big challenge for Rob Pelinka this summer. You've got to find those high-level starter players, not stars, but high-level starter level players to support your big three. Maybe it's a big two this summer. But Jason, let's jump over to the big three themselves. I'm getting less confidence by the day that LeBron, Luka, and Austin is going to work. Some of that is not necessarily all on them. Some of that is the pieces you have to place around them. But where are you at on LeBron, Luka, and Austin hitting net positive by the end of the season? Because let's face it, that is priority number one for JJ Redick, winning basketball while LeBron, Luka, and Austin are on the floor by the playoffs. Can they get there?
Yeah, so this... I have complicated feelings about this because I do think that there's a certain playoff viability with these three, because Luka and LeBron both over the last several years, LeBron as like this older player and Luka is just an unathletic player. They both have been guys who like in the postseason are pretty diligent about like doing their job on defense to where they can like raise the floor in their role well enough. Austin, I think, has always been a guy, even at his age, who just does his job. He can get physically overwhelmed, and he got physically overwhelmed several times last night by Peyton Pritchard and Jaylen Brown. But like, there's a certain amount of like in a postseason series, I can count on those guys to do their jobs. And then on the offensive end, while they struggled, I think they're capable of playing a lot better offensively than they did. Austin was bad last night, and he was getting, I was watching the film again this morning, and I'm like, Austin has torched these upright wings all season long. Like the guards, the guys like Cason Wallace have given him some issues. Some of the smaller ball pressure guards have given him issues, but like the Jaden McDaniels types, the 6'7", 6'8", like taller, lankier wings, he's had a lot of success against. And he had Sam Hauser on him for a good chunk of the game last night. Like, I mean, Austin's capable of playing a lot better offensively. Where I think it gets tricky is like, as I'm looking at the specific runs in the game last night, there are a lot of defensive mistakes that have been made by LeBron and Luka in particular in these stretches. And really, that's the biggest issue. I talked about that lineup, right? The lineup, it was like Ayton, LeBron, Luka, Rui, and Luke Kennard that gave up the run right before the end of the half. It's like, yeah, you can put Austin in there, but it's still LeBron and Luka, and Ayton obviously has his issues to where they're not habitual guys doing those things in the regular season. They're not going to, as a matter of habit, box out the corner crash every time or like track shooters and off-ball movement every single time. Luka gets badly back cut by Baylor Shireman out of the right corner. LeBron leaves Derek White wide open in the left corner. LeBron gives up an offensive rebound because Baylor Shireman runs right around him and gets a tap out offensive rebound in that third quarter run. It's like, these are things where it's like, I kind of expect a 41-year-old LeBron and a Luka who's got a damn near 40% usage rate to be guys who are just like, nah, whatever, during the regular season when it comes to doing their jobs on that stuff. And so do I think that LeBron, Luka, Austin, plus Nick Claxton and Herb Jones could go win a bunch of playoff series? I do. I think that team in a all dead serious basketball has a certain like imposition that they provide because of the depth of shot creation. But as a regular season build, it's so deeply flawed because you're trying to do what the Celtics are doing and establish habits and culture and build this like intensity that's like, yeah, we're up 10 and playing great basketball, but this is still unacceptable because we're trying to build something here. It's so hard to do that when your stars are just not those types of dudes. You know, like Jaylen Brown's the best player on the Celtics. He had a lot of like high effort, high motor type of sequences yesterday. And like, that's really the fundamental flaw in this trio is that they were never, ever going to be a group that cares enough about the details in the regular season.
Jovan, what does that mean moving forward for this team, both the rest of the season and beyond?
Well, so I looked it up last night on my show, and I just looked up the updated numbers. So if we look at, because we could obviously split them individually, but I think in general, the Lakers are, especially in a playoff context, either going to have three or two of the big three on for, you know, most minutes, right? Like there might occasionally be a Luka only stretch or a LeBron only stretch, but I think all the three of those guys are going to be in the high 30s minutes, if not around the 40. I mean, Luka will probably be like 40, 42 minutes a night. So you're going to have some overlap there, right? Like it's primarily going to be a combination of two or a combination of the three. And looking at the lineup data so far, with the three on, or with some combination of LeBron and Luka or LeBron and Austin. So three of the four, two or three man combinations, they have a 121 or worse defensive rating, which would be the worst defense in the NBA. So I think to summarize it as succinctly as possible, they cannot defend with the big three on the floor or when LeBron has been one of the two guys with one of, you know, the other stars. They've been great with Luka and Austin as the only two guys. They have a 108 defensive rating, which would be the second best defense in the NBA behind only OKC. I don't think that is sustainable. I think there's some noise within that. But certainly with LeBron off, the Luka and Austin on, I mean, they have a plus 19 net rating with those two on and no LeBron. So like that, I think they need to lean more into the Luka Austin groupings. And then LeBron of the individual guys has been the best in terms of like by himself, that the Lakers are plus 9 with LeBron on solo. So like, I think there's a natural way to divvy this up of, I think you're going to start the big three and they're going to play like, you know, beginning of the first quarter, beginning of the third quarter, they're going to have to close together basically like end of fourth. And then you might close like end of second with them. But outside of that, I think you need to stagger them as much as humanly possible and really lean into the Luka AR pairing. And then also lean into LeBron, as we've seen some of these bench groups with LeBron, a bunch of size, a bunch of athleticism, a bunch of motor, and those groups playing zone. One thing I will note, and I will kick this back to you guys, going through the data, it is a relatively small sample size. It's not at the 250 mark that JJ has referenced, but with the big three on and DeAndre Ayton as the center, the Lakers have a 124 defensive rating, which is mind-boggling. Bad. It's bad. It's atrocious, right? With Jackson on, they have a 115.5 defensive rating. And so that's nearly a 9-point swing. And I do wonder if, you know, politics aside and just like what's best for the team, and with how DA has been playing the last couple of months, are we getting to a point where they have to consider potentially going back to Jackson as the starting center? And like, they were much better defensively last year in the minutes that Jackson was the starting center compared to this year. I think we're starting to get to that point where you have to consider, like, that's more of a Hail Mary. Like you are risking losing DA and him checking out and like all the bad things that you've heard about him in Portland and Phoenix rearing up as a backup. But like, if we're being completely honest about the performance up to this point, I think Jackson's been their best center over the past 2 months. And the lineup data, while limited, does support. There's a pretty big defensive shift there with Jackson with the big three versus DA.
If they did that, if they went and moved DA out of the starting lineup, would he just collapse in on himself like a dying star?
Probably, but I mean, what did he do last night then? You know what I mean? True. Like at a certain point, I'm with Jovan. Like at a certain point, I think it's just like anything else. You owe situations like this a long runway, but we've had a long runway at this point. And I think we're entering into the territory of like, okay, this team is going to be fundamentally different next year. Like you're going to have, in all likelihood, several different role players, maybe one or two different starters. LeBron could very well not be on the team anymore next year. So this is now looking like a very much a in a vacuum type of season. This season is its own entity and its own separate thing. And so I no longer think you have to care about Ayton's feelings. And frankly, if you're planning on trying to trade him and or not using him next season anyway, then I think it makes some sense to, you know, maybe send that message within this season. I don't think necessarily I would make the swap yet. I would just be quicker with the hook. I would just, with everything with JJ, I would just be quick to pull Ayton, which, by the way, he has been for a long time now. And
except for the
Clippers, I mean, like we saw a lot yesterday, I mean, Jackson gets hurt and you still just end up going small a ton instead of bumping up Ayton's minutes. He only plays 25 minutes. So, like, I think in general, it's just about being quick with the hook.
Yeah, I agree. And JJ has been pretty proactive. I mean, in aside from the Clippers game where DA played 28 minutes to close the game, all of that, it's been more minutes going to Jackson Hayes. We've seen the pecking order beat, at least to close games. It's been Jackson Hayes slash small ball in whatever order you want. And then sometimes Maxey and then DA. He's been either the third or the fourth preferred option in terms of closing out games. I don't know that you need to make this swap right now in terms of...
I think the only thing I'll quickly say, I don't mean to interrupt. I think like we focused a lot on the Luka LeBron... Sure. Rui pairing or trio and the defensive struggles with those three and how like I think those three should just never play together just straight up, but like, you know, they've definitely reduced the minutes of those three. I think it's a similar, like, you know, and Jason just laid it out with that lineup that played last night together. I think it's similarly problematic of when you have, if Luka, LeBron and DA are your three helpers and low men in a defensive group, I just think your floor is basically non-existent. And so I'm also kind of like, I think you have to play Luka and LeBron together because they are two of the three best players on the team. Again, they're going to start, they're going to play a certain amount of time together. You can't change that. But I think you have to think about what you're putting around those guys. And for as concerning as I think the Luka, LeBron, Rui minutes have been, I think DA also within that, like the lineup data is right there where with DA, it's basically been just as bad as with Rui in there. So it's like, if we're going to make the case that Luka, LeBron and Rui, you don't have enough perimeter defense, I think Luka, LeBron and DA, you don't have enough frontline defense. So, I mean, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think JJ is going to pull the plug, but I think we have a growing sample size here of like, I think you need to reduce those minutes a lot and potentially even eliminate them. But I don't think that's going to happen though.
To your point, it's only 113 possessions, but Luka, LeBron, and Austin on the floor together without DeAndre Ayton, they're a plus 2.4 in 113 possessions. And again, tiny sample size, 113.
Better than minus 10.
Better than minus 10. Absolutely. Absolutely. What does this say when we look at this big three? In terms of the long-term future for this group, the fact that we're talking about, well, you have to split up LeBron as his own entity, LeBron and the Banshees needs to be a team effectively. And then Luka and Austin needs to be a thing too. And you need to prioritize those things. Guys, aren't you just inherently screwed if that's the case, right? Like you should be at your best with your three best players on the floor, right?
Yes, they are screwed.
I mean, like that's what it drills down to though, doesn't it?
Yeah,
Go ahead, Jason.
You're fine. As a team construct, I think, again, I think in the regular season, it is borderline impossible to sustain anything with that group just simply because of, again, it's not a habit. I've seen Luka and LeBron both, even LeBron at his age, be able to tighten up and be a very good backline defender and rebounder for spurts, particularly at the end of games. But there's just a lack of possession to possession floor, like Jovan said. It's just the what you actually need every single possession in order to sustain a decent defensive rating is like these certain jobs that get done every time, and they're just not getting done. And so I think, you know, as you build forward with the team, ultimately without LeBron in the picture, that's what this roster is going to have to look like. We can talk about Austin. Like, there's a separate conversation to have where Austin just continues to look bad in these big games, which is I think there's a conversation to have about why Austin looked good against Minnesota, but has struggled against some of these other teams that can guard him with some of the smaller wings. Like, when teams have small fire hydrant guards, they tend to cause Austin some problems. And then when Austin has to guard power wings, guys that can go through him, he can have some problems. But ultimately, I think this group has to have 3-4-5 in the starting lineup, dudes who are just rock solid on the fundamentals every single possession. And that's just the exact opposite of what you're getting from LeBron and DeAndre Ayton right now. And so, you know, on the one hand, like, when you look at the dudes around the league that do that job, like, I'm not shocked that 41-year-old LeBron doesn't want to do the job. But, like, at the same time, if you're going to have success in this construct, you have to have somebody in that spot that's going to do the job.
I'm glad you brought up LeBron and the job, because that's something that's been on my mind a lot, is that, and this is not criticism of LeBron, but the LeBron they need is not the LeBron they're getting right now. And I'm talking about the focal points for him. What you need from LeBron, because frankly, and this is to a degree an indictment of the other guys, because you can't get this out of Luka, you can't get this out of Austin, but they need a LeBron who is burning most of his energy on the glass defensively, doing those things, because of those three, he's the most capable of doing that. I think they're not getting that, nor is it necessarily fair to ask that of 41-year-old LeBron James, but the LeBron they need is not the LeBron that they're getting right now. I don't know if there is, at this stage of the season, a shift where we're going to see LeBron take on that role, or if that's even possible, but from a conceptual level, that third player that they need, if you're going to have somebody with Luka and Austin, has to be somebody that could do things that I think in the past you could have gotten out of LeBron. I think of Kobe with the Olympic team when he took on the defensive stopper role because they had so much firepower and so much scoring around them. The LeBron of a few years ago probably could have shifted into that kind of a role on a team that had a lot of offensive firepower and really be the rock solid backbone of the defense. And I think we saw LeBron do that a little bit last year post Luka trade. He really took on a lot of the Anthony Davis role on the back line defensively. I don't know if this version of LeBron this year is capable of doing that. Doesn't change the fact that it's what the Lakers need, but to me, it throws into question, if he's not capable of being that, what will the summer look like with the big three? Are you able to re-up this group and keep it around, even if it is at a reduced price tag for LeBron James? Or do you find yourself just so far behind the eight ball defensively that despite LeBron being more talented than some of the other names that are out there potentially on the market, whether it be a trade or free agency, that it's still a net negative compared to going to somebody who might check the boxes that Luka and Austin need around them?
To your point, why did LeBron take twice as many shots as Austin, but is like not boxing out of the corner and not like doing his job on the back line? Like, and to your point about the Kobe Olympics and things like that, again, I'm not worried about LeBron so much about this job if the playoff series starts tomorrow. Sure. Like, I think he's going to do his job and leave it all out there. It's just like, it's just a fundamentally broken regular season construct.
We've got, so the big three, well, you know what, before we leave the big three, Jovan, let's talk about Austin. Where are we at on Austin Reeves? He had the lowest usage percentage of the season in last night's game. Another game though, against a big time opponent where you needed a big game out of Austin Reeves, didn't get it. There's certainly some defensive concerns there. I ran the numbers. I pulled just looking through some of the stats against the top 10 defenses in terms of defensive rating today, not necessarily when he played those. So these numbers can be skewed a little bit, but Austin's shooting about three fewer free throws per game when the Lakers are playing the top defenses in the league. His 3-point percentage drops about 7 or 8% when they're playing the top defensive teams. Where are you at on Austin in all of this? Because certainly we could talk about LeBron, we could talk about Luka. Austin's the guy that they're going to have to pay this summer that they clearly want to keep around. Where does this leave us?
I think it's concerning. And you know, I think about the four losses that they've had against the top 10 teams in the league with the big three. He was subpar in that Spurs game. He was subpar in that Suns game. He was subpar last night. I actually think the Rockets game, I mean, he left that game early due to injury. I thought he had some good stretches in that game, and actually of the big three was like the one who was like, remember he got downhill a few times against Thompson, and like he was actually kind of cooking Şengün a bit in pick and roll, but you know, ended up getting injured in that one, whatever. But we have this sample size here of, I mean, I think about like some of the OKC games, right? And just their ability to contain him, where, I mean, if you can, if you have a certain caliber of defender who he can't create, like a lot of Austin's game obviously is between his footwork, his speed, his handle, he's able to create this separation, and he just needs a sliver of space to get to the mid-range pull-up or some of the pull-up threes or getting to the rim and drawing fouls. And if you can contain him and stick with him, and you have a certain level of physical profile, like we see with a Caruso or a Kayson Wallace in the OKC matchup, or we saw last night with a Derek White, like you, I mean, dead, he's kind of out of options. And I actually thought defensively he held up like okay last night. I thought he had some nice defensive possessions against Derek White, but and had seven defensive rebounds, which like they, I mean, tied for team lead. So like, I think there's some things there that he still contributes when he's not scoring as much. But if the Lakers are going to pay him 35 plus million, 40 plus million, you need a certain amount of baseline production from him of like these games. I mean, there's too many 14 point, 15 point, 18 yep. point on like 40-ish percent shooting. That needs to be 22 plus, 24 plus on closer to 50% shooting more consistently against these top teams. So while I have remained an Austin optimist in general, I do acknowledge that there have been some really concerning trends this season. And we'll like the Lakers are, I think have 10 more games against the top 10 teams in the league. We'll see how he fares in those games. And then they're going to get a playoff matchup with one of the top 10 teams in the league. And we'll see how he fares there. But if he continues to struggle the rest of the regular season and into the playoffs, or not even like struggle, but just kind of be a bit underwhelming, that is a whole different conversation that we'll be having after the season in terms of what his potential fit is with Luka and how much money he should be making. I still think, even if, let's just say he plays the exact same way the rest of the season against the top 10 teams, the best move is still to re-sign him. Yes. And then either, I mean, you could sign and trade, or you could retain him, flip him next season. But I mean, I still think those two options are far better than just letting him walk and like praying that you can find a way to replace him in free agency. It's still better to keep him, but that number is going to decrease. If he continues to play like this against the best teams, undoubtedly that number is going to drop from like 42 million, maybe into the mid 30s. So, or even, I mean, who knows? We'll see how the rest of the season goes, but certainly concern with the recent play against some of these teams.
Jovan, you said something at the start of the show that you don't care about the Lakers. I'm paraphrasing, but you don't care about the Lakers beating the bad teams anymore. You're focusing on how they play against the best teams. Does the same hold true for Austin Reeves now moving forward?
Yeah, I would say so. I will say referenced it a little bit earlier, or Jason referenced it, like he had the huge game against Minnesota, 28 and 16, hit the game winning shot. He had the 44 in Toronto, which, you know, Rui hit the game winning shot in that game. He had 51 against Sacramento, but like he's had some big games against some good teams and some good defenses, but it hasn't been like the top teams. And that's the standard that we're ultimately going to be holding him against. So I think he's proven that, like, yes, he can put up all-star level numbers. He can be an all-star level player, but can you do it against the best teams, against the best defenses, and in the biggest moments? That, like, the jury is still out on that. And, I mean, right now it's been a concerning sample size. We'll see if he can turn that around. But if he can't, then again, we have to have a different conversation here as to where he's at in the hierarchy of a great team and how much money he deserves to make off of that.
Agreed. Yeah, agreed. And that's going to be a really important thing to focus on as we go through the season here and as we get closer and closer to the playoffs. It's going to be huge for him to step up in some of these big games, and especially come playoff time. Otherwise, that it's going to be some difficult conversations, I think, this summer if we don't see that. He still had a great season, no question. But
for sure,
you need some of those big step-up games and the big moments. And you know, you could argue some more shots should have been funneled to him last night than what we saw. But nonetheless, he's got a lot he still has to prove, I think, through the remainder of the season and into the playoffs.
Can I add something just really quick?
Yes, please.
Like, again, I when I rewatched the game, I was a little less hard on Austin than I was when I was watching it live, just because there was a little bit of a weird flow to the game, or to your point, like for a team that was running as much drop coverage, I just like to see Austin get more attempts. He also deserves some blame for that. As we mentioned, the over penetration that was happening, or like he had a bad one late in the game where he went downhill at Vucevic and like the on-ball defender got wiped out by the screen and he had the entire middle of the floor to work with. And instead he just drove into Vucevic's chest and like threw some garbage up that had no shot of going in. So like more reps, you know, better just attention to detail on his reps. I think he could do better. The last thing I would say is, like, in general, even though I see the big picture issues with Austin, I would just bet on him figuring it out. There have been so many times in Austin's career where a red flag has come up and it's looked like he's had this weakness or this issue in his game and then he's just solved it. I mean, just as recently as the beginning of last year, he looked like a guy that maybe wasn't ready for high volume guard responsibilities. I mean, D'Lo looked better than him. It was like, oh my gosh, what's going on here? Now, he got more reps when D'Lo got traded and he was handed more of the keys to the offense. But the point being is, like, he put that narrative completely to bed before the end of that season. And then now you just sound like an idiot after what happened at the beginning of this season. Like, we all know Austin can play lead guard in this league. It's a question of whether or not he can do it at a championship level. My thing is, like, for a guy that's conquered every single demon to this point in his career, I would just bet on Austin going into the lab and figuring it out. Whether it's just like more surgical work with the jump shot or improving his muscle mass so he can handle some of these ball pressure physical guards a little better. I just would bet on Austin figuring it out.
No, it's a great point. It's a great point. All right, let's talk a little bit about Luka. Obviously, we're talking about the big three here. Luka fifth in the MVP straw poll. Last night was not Luka's finest game. I'm at a point where I am pretty confident teams are game planning to get Luka complaining, and once they do, they're right. I mean, they had he thought he got fouled on a made three, and Hugo Gonzalez beat him down the floor for a layup. Give me up a layup off of a made three because Luka stayed on the floor and complained. There have been some moments that have been really great from Luka. I love the way they were moving the ball against the Clippers. Last night against the Celtics, I thought was the bad version of Luka, where you saw him baited into a lot of kind of one-on-one tough shots. Now, some of it we could say the rest of the team was very stagnant off ball, and I wanted to see more happening there. But we got a lot of complaining from the Lakers in general in last night's game. Luka certainly can be part of that. I don't think he was actually one of the ones that got a technical in last night's game. There were other players who did, but
he joked after the game, that's how bad you knew the reffing was that he didn't get the tech.
That was pretty good.
I love that.
But, where are you guys at on Luka at this point? Fifth in the MVP voting. Is that where he should be? Should he be higher? And how are we feeling about his game right now?
Can I say something about the refs quick?
Yeah.
Do I think every call went the way that it should have in that game? No. Were there some pretty egregious missed ones? There was one in the third quarter where Jaylen Brown like bad shoved off Austin for a no call, like damn near shoved him over the baseline. The missed goaltending call on the LeBron layup. Like there were some bad calls in that game. I thought the whistle reflected the huge gap in physicality and effort between the two teams. I did not think the officiating was a huge factor in that game. I thought the Lakers got bullied. And you have two things you can do in that case. You can be, guess what? The Lakers are big and strong. They can bully teams too. You can either bully them back and meet the physicality of the moment, or you can complain and lose. And that's what the Lakers decided to do last night. And I generally thought the officiating, again, some bad missed calls. I generally didn't think the officiating was a factor. But Jovan, you can go on the Luka MVP thing. I just wanted to rant about that for a sec.
I would also add to that, and I made this point last night on my show, that I think the Lakers generally come out on like the neutral side at a minimum with the refs, if not the positive side. And I think sometimes it can feel like they're getting screwed because some of the, we could say grifting calls or just some of the contact that they're used to maybe getting called at times on certain drives and shots doesn't happen in some of these games against better defenses and more physical teams. But I think if we were grading like the average Lakers game, I do think they come out at least neutral, if not positive, mm-hmm. On the average night. And yes, there have been some games recently, like the OKC game or last night, where I don't think it was a great ref game, and you had the goaltending call and you had some of the offensive foul calls I felt like were 50-50, but it's still like I don't think there should be a narrative that like the Lakers are continually getting screwed. I just don't agree with that. Luka, so I actually have a vote with the straw poll, and I had Luka third in my voting, so I don't agree with the fifth place, but it like, I mean, there's almost like, it really depends how, what you look at, what you prioritize, but like, obviously, I mean, I think OKC and Denver just have better teams than the Lakers, so that's naturally going to give Shea and Jokic an advantage in terms of typically an MVP is on like a top two or three seed mm-hmm. team. There are some exceptions like Russ in 2017, but I would also argue that Russ in 2017 is looked at as like one of the worst recent MVP seasons. And like some people, we've had voters come out and say like they made a mistake voting for Russ or that, you know, they wish they voted for someone else. So I just think like that kind of sets a precedent of like, you kind of have to be a top two or three seed. I think the pathway for Luka to winning MVP would be Lakers being the three seed. I think if they're four or lower, he just doesn't have a shot. But what that did show me is I think he's a long shot to win MVP, just because if he's going to be fifth behind Cade and Wemby, like Jokic is close to being out due to the game's missed rule. Yep. Wemby is also somewhat close, but he's still behind then Shea and Cade with like, I would say like 70 to 80% of the people voting are going to have MVP votes. So this is pretty reflective of the general consensus around MVP voters. I think Luka's in a tough spot there where like, if he's fifth right now, I think he has a pretty big mountain to climb in terms of getting into the top three or even just winning it. But I had him third. I think he's the third best player in the NBA. Again, comparing him to Shea and Jokic, those guys clear him in every advanced metric. They actually clear him too. And like, I know a big argument for Laker fans or Luka fans who think he should be MVP is like, we'll look at his supporting cast versus those other teams. But like, those other teams actually have like Jokic, there's a bigger on-off difference with Denver with Jokic on versus off than there is with Luka. There's a bigger on-off difference with OKC with Shea on off than there is with Luka. So like, even the gap between on and off is actually like almost double with both of those guys compared to Luka. So there is like, those guys have been the best two players in the league. I think those are the two best MVP candidates, but I would have Luka third. Clearly a lot of people, you know, barely have him on the ballot, which I found surprising.
Yeah, doesn't suggest that he's got a great shot at it. I think it would basically require SGA to fall off in terms of the games played, that becoming an issue. And even then, it probably defaults to Cade. Maybe, you know, Wemby can get in there. I think Luka at some point can win an MVP, but I think what it's going to take is the Lakers, as you said, being the three seed in the West. But even if they're the three seed, there's still going to be a gap between the Lakers and the top two. Like, there's a group competing for three right now, including Denver, Houston, Phoenix, maybe falling off of some injuries that they've had so far, the Wolves. But even if they're the three seed, they're still going to be seen as a gap between the Lakers and those top two. And certainly we look at the top of the East. And I've long said, I think we factor in team success too much in the MVP voting, that it should be more of an individual award and it shouldn't just automatically go to whatever team is the number one or the number two seed in their conference. But that said, I would agree with you that Luka should be third on the list, but whether he's third or fifth, I don't think he's actually winning it this season. I think narrative matters a lot around teams. The Lakers have had a lot of turmoil this season, a lot of ups and downs, hasn't been a lot of consistency. They haven't had the big statement wins. All of that, I think, is going to matter. So I don't see Luka actually coming away with the award. Now, I will say, if he never wins an MVP, that would be certainly a disappointment. But we came into the season saying it was possible for him to win the MVP this season. For a lot of reasons, I don't think that's going to happen. at some point he needs to check that box and get one. Hopefully it'll happen next season. Jason, where are you at on Luka and his play?
I actually have him fourth. I'd put Cade above him. I think Cade actually has like a pretty decent long shot MVP case. I think Shea's clearly going to win. I think Jokic is going to end up getting eliminated by missing a game or two at some point. I think he only has to miss two more to get eliminated. So I guess if there's one method for Luka to move up to third, it would be Jokic dropping out entirely. But then again, Luka himself could end up dropping out entirely if he ends up getting another, you know, week-long injury. But it really is this simple to me. If Luka's case is, because Luka does not bring any sort of additional element to the table. Like Cade's actually a pretty damn good two-way player. Like Cade's showed some real defensive chops this season at various points. Jokic in particular, if you're going the offensive engine route, like, oh, Luka's this deeply valuable offensive engine, I think Jokic is just better than him at that. Shea at this point has even been better than him at that specifically. The case for Cade, though, is best player on best team in the league. I think the Pistons have been far and away the most successful regular season team this year. Their record is slightly better than OKC, and they've been way, 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 way better against the best teams in the league. Detroit has had just marquee win after marquee win after marquee win. So, like, to me, Cade just has a much better MVP case, because if it's just who's the best player, yeah, you're probably going to take Luka. But Cade just has all these other feathers in his cap that traditionally get factored in for MVP. As far as the big picture goes with Luka, I kind of talked about this a little bit on my show last week, but in order for Luka to eventually become a guy that isn't just a preseason hype man for MVP, but a guy who's actually in contention for it, he's got to improve his floor. Like Jovan and I actually talked about this last week when we were doing player grades, but like, I think Luka's ceiling is potentially the highest in the entire NBA, and it's because of the three-point shot and the playmaking. Like, Shea and Jokic, neither of those two are capable of having games where they hit 8 or 9 threes by just getting step-back threes off, because that's how good they are with their size at getting step-back threes off. Luka can. Luka can get to this point where when he's got his step-back three going, he's the most unguardable player in the NBA, because he brings the short-range scoring of Nikola Jokic, the off-the-dribble shot-making of Shea, with the efficiency of Steph Curry at the three-point line, and the playmaking of the best passers in the league. Like, Luka's ceiling might be the highest ceiling in the entire NBA, but the floor is just so much lower. Like, he's so much more turnover-prone than any of those guys. He's so much more prone to cold shooting nights than any of those guys. He is by far the worst defensive player on that list. Like, there's just a much lower floor there. Like, you know, Luka will have a game like last night where, by the way, he shot the three reasonably well, but he was 1 for 11 on twos outside of the restricted area, where he just can't make any of those shots. And all of a sudden it's like, well, if they're running drop coverage and they're guarding 2-on-2 and you can't hit those shots, you're not anywhere close to the offensive engine that some of these other guys in the league are. Like, Shea will be able to just get all the way to the rim as a slasher a bunch to be able to counteract that, right? Or Jokic will be able to get closer to the basket, so he's less susceptible to variance. Or, you know, guys like Cade or Giannis have more two-way kind of potential. I think the floor with Luka has to be addressed if he ever wants to win an MVP.
Yeah, agree with that. Agree with that. I think that's something that's got to improve with him. Will he get there? Does it happen?
Man. He's 20. He's going to be 27 soon.
That's the thing.
What about you? What do you think, Jovan?
Yep, Jovan's muted.
Throwback to our first couple shows. I like to mute myself when I'm not speaking, just in case there's any random sounds. I think he gets there. I think he gets an MVP, but I think it's probably going to be in like 2 to 3 years, and the Lakers are going to need to really reshape the roster around him. Like, part of it, I think, will ultimately come down to, can the Lakers, or if he's eventually on like another team, you know, we'll see, can they put like the right group around him? But I think if you go back to like the 2023-24 season, he obviously was a strong contender for MVP. It was in the inner circle mix there. So I do think like the record and team success is sort of like the barrier to entry of like, if you're not a top 3 or 4 seed, you almost just don't get considered anymore, with the exception of Westbrook, which like that, there was a novelty component there of first player to average a triple double. There was also, I think we've seen narrative play a big role in MVP at times, where like Derrick Rose winning it in 2011, Russ winning it in 2017. It was like people were anti LeBron in 2011, anti KD in 2017. Those guys got a boost narrative wise in the MVP. So there's a lot of different things that go into it, but I think for Luka, like the actualized version of Luka winning MVP is like putting up his best numbers and similar numbers to the ones he's put up in over the last few years, but also the team success being there in a way that it just up to this point in LA, at least, has not been.
All right. We are going to get into some of the question and answer section here. I know the chat is talking all about Luka right now. We're going to take your questions, your comments in just a moment. But first, Jason's going to tell us a bit about our sponsor, and that is Factor.
All right, quick break, and this one's actually something I've been using personally. Cold days, big games, busy schedule, no time to cook. That's why I've been rocking with Factor. I've been ordering their Protein Plus meals, especially the grilled chicken with roasted veggies. Perfect for me because I'm trying to keep my energy high for shows without feeling heavy after eating. What I like about Factor, quality ingredients, lean proteins, real veggies, whole food fats, no refined sugars, no artificial sweeteners, no refined seed oils, and it fits the schedule. They've got 100 rotating meals weekly, keto, calorie smart, Mediterranean, GLP-1 support, even a new Muscle Pro collection for strength and recovery. And the convenience is crazy. Always fresh, never frozen, ready in about 2 minutes, no prep, no stress. I use this, and you guys should too, especially if you're balancing work, school, gym, and Lakers games every night. Head to factormeals.com/LakersPod50off. And use code LakersPod50off to get your 50% off your first box, plus free breakfast for a year. That's 50% off and a free breakfast item in every box for a year while your subscription is still active. Go again, factormeals.com/LakersPod50off, code LakersPod50off. Let's get back to it.
Sorry, Chase, I should have been following along with you there. Oh, see, I'm all off. I took a week off from vacation, and that's what happens. All right, thank you, everybody. Make sure you check out Factor. They are awesome. I love Factor. They're so easy and so tasty as well. All right, let's go here. Let's get into some of your questions, your comments. Kevin said, do you think Rob will be desperate in the summer and overpay some free agents? For example, $25 million for Grimes, $25 million for Mitch Robinson. It is not a lot of depth out there in free agency. I mean, Jovan, that reminds me of a few years ago when Jeannie Buss removed her brother Jim Buss and Mitch Kupchak out of fear that they were going to do something stupid at the trade deadline in order to try to save their jobs. Could eagerness to use their cap space and or draft picks to improve the roster right away actually lead to problematic moves?
Yeah. I think that that is a concern and a risk this summer. I mean, you have to use the cap space, right? Like the Lakers are not going to be some like lottery team that's way under the cap. Like you typically see that only be the case in, I mean, there's like a minimum, there's a salary floor you have to get to. And then, there's penalties if you're under that. I'm not going to dive too much into that, but like typically the lower spending teams are the teams that are tanking are the teams that don't have ambitions to win and might want to function as a dumping ground at some point in either the offseason or in the regular season going into the deadline. So that's not going to be the case with the Lakers. They will spend a certain amount. And I think there's a disaster scenario that's like semi-plausible where LeBron either retires or leaves. You rescind some of, you're trying to go for Giannis, you're trying to go for some of these restricted free agents. Maybe you rescind the rights of Rui. We'll see what happens with DA and Marcus. Maybe you get cute with Austin and the negotiations, or maybe Austin just, you feel like isn't the right fit with Luka and you let him walk, or you trade him or something. And the Lakers are kind of caught having to spend a certain amount of money on either overpays or like a bunch of 1 year deals, one plus ones, whatever, where now you're trying to roll it over again to 2027. I don't think that's going to happen. I will note, I've been starting to think more about the free agent class just to see like just think about like what makes sense. I've grown more optimistic on the potential fit with Mitchell Robinson. You know, I think he has declined physically in general. He's not as much of a lob threat as he used to be. He's not as athletic. He's dealt with a lot of injuries. And really going back to the 2023-24 season when he missed that big stretch, since then he's only played 30 minutes in a game once in the regular season. So New York has put him in bubble wrap to a degree. But based on the options that are out there, he is someone that 25 is high for me. I would not want to pay him that much. But in like the $18-20 million range, if there is not another, like, of course, if you could get Kessler or Claxton or some of these other guys that we like more, yeah, you go get that guy. But if it's just Mitchell Robinson or DeAndre Ayton, I would rather have Mitchell Robinson on like an $18-20 million contract. Maybe you make it a short one, like offer him two years, 40 million, something like that. But I think he's a notable upgrade over DA.
I do wonder too, if they could potentially get a center, whether it's Mitchell Robinson, like that kind of idea where you have a player think, oh, maybe if I play with Luka for a year or two, I could get a bigger payday, like that kind of idea.
Yeah.
Which had to be some of DA's thinking when he joined the Lakers this year.
If only the game was just dunking,
right?
If only the season ended in mid-December,
then he'd be on path for a big payday for sure. Yeah, I'm checking out the center market right now. I mean, Isaiah Hartenstein might be out there. Other than that, there's a reason why when we look around the NBA and the Pacers are in some circles viewed as having overpaid a bit to get Ivica Zubac. Part of that is the center market this summer is not great and they want to be able to win next year. That it's going to be a real question how the Lakers navigate this center market, what Rob Pelinka does there, because Mitchell Robinson is certainly a name out there. If you miss on it, what if Mitch Rob just says, no, I want to stay in New York, or if he's got some other landing spot, there's going to be other teams after him. Not a lot of depth out there on the market after that. And that's not even just the center position. That's a lot of free agency this summer. So I am curious to see what they do there. A lot of Lakers fans will immediately say Walker Kessler. I don't see him as realistically available. If there was a number the Jazz were going to break on for Walker Kessler, I would imagine they probably would have taken the two first round picks that the Pacers reportedly offered them back in February, or back at the beginning of the month, I should say. And they didn't. So that tells me they're probably not going to allow Walker Kessler to walk away. So it's going to be interesting to see what Rob Pelinka does this summer. The next question does kind of bleed into this. Do I think Rob is on the hot seat if he doesn't put together a competent roster this summer? I think a lot of it, and Jason, tell me what you think about this, but I think a lot of it's going to depend on what does Luka think? Because so far, all we've heard is Luka's on board with the Lakers being disciplined, I think is the word that they use, but essentially kicking the can down the road another cycle, going to the, okay, we're going to go to the summer now. We'll make our moves at that point. Does Luka start getting frustrated? Because it's not that far off from Luka having a little bit of say in terms of if he wants to leave, he could get out because he'd have free agency coming up in 2028.
Yeah, I think if Rob botches this summer and the team looks mediocre to very slightly better to start next season, I think Rob will be on the hot seat. I think like at a certain point, that at being the third season in the Luka era where you feel like you don't have a shot to win a title, that would just start to settle in a way mentally that'd be really hard for any great competitor to handle, let alone, you know, one of the guys who's one of the top tier superstars in our league. So I think anybody with any semblance of competence and leadership, if Rob can't make the at least the first step towards a substantial improvement in the team this summer, I think you've got to look in a different direction.
Let's go here. Jay said, or is it Jamie? Said, I want Bron, Vando, Smart lineup against second units. Throw in Kennard and Hayes too. Bron, Vando, Smart lineups have been good. LeBron and Smart, two of the higher volume three-point shooters or two of the top four in terms of volume three-point shooters. Obviously, Luka way ahead of everybody else. Neither one above league average. In fact, of the Lakers' top four volume-wise three-point shooters, only one of them is above league average, and that's Austin Reeves. Luka just slightly below league average. But that would be my concern, the shooting. In a lot, even with Kennard out there, I'd have concerns about shooting. But Jovan, the other side of me says, this lineup could probably get stops, and if you can get out and run and you've got Kennard filling the wing to provide spacing, there is an element of this that could work. I'd be concerned about them getting caught in half-court offense situations and having that little shooting on the floor.
Yeah, I also, in general, like the pairings of... So Vando here, like Vando has been much better with LeBron than he has been with Luka. Mm-hmm. Vando and Luka have just not clicked. And if you look at the lineup data with Vando on with Luka versus Vando with Braun, there's like he's clearly been much better with LeBron out there. I also think there's an element here of that with Jackson and DA. I think Luka optimizes Jackson in a way that Austin and LeBron just don't. And I actually think Austin and LeBron optimize DA and with their passing style of like one thing I think LeBron has done a great job with both DA and Jackson, but I think it more so applies to DA is like he'll fire those like quick little bullet passes where he starts to back down a little bit. And once he sees that the center shift over even the slightest, he fires that bullet pass into the middle of the lane to DA or to Jackson. I think those types of plays keep DA a bit more engaged. So in by nature, I kind of like the Braun Vando DA pairing as a second unit grouping. So that would be my one tweak here is I'd probably swap in DA for Jackson and keep Jackson and Luka together. Like that also maximizes Luka where Luka needs the lob threat. Like that's when he's at his best. And Jackson's just a much better lob threat than DA. So I think I would stagger it that way a little bit. But I mean, the bones of this lineup, like we've kind of seen this recently where JJ has leaned into those bigger second unit groupings with LeBron that play the 2-3 zone. We've seen Timmy in some of these lineups. We've seen Maxi Kleba in some of these lineups. But like the double bigs plus LeBron and Vando, LeBron and Rui, like we've seen that work. So I like it. Again, if you want to throw in Kennard there as like a shooter and he could play in the zone, that's fine. I just would lean Ayton over Hayes.
Yeah, I'm in agreement with that. I don't mind the idea of this lineup. I think this is something that they're going to have to turn to more often than not. LeBron and the Banshees effectively is what we're talking about here. Ayton can be out there with that grouping. There's a reason why Jackson Hayes is playing with Slovenia, right? There's a reason why they went and are adding him to that roster. He does have that mind meld with Luka. And maybe that speaks to our prior conversation about maybe even bumping Jackson Hayes into the starting lineup. But I think these are some of the more effective lineups that they've had out there with their bench units when you've got LeBron and the guys who are really going to defend at a high level. Lakers turned into the 2014-2017 version when facing real teams. Luka, I think we're downplaying how bad those 2014 through 2017 Lakers were. Those were lean times, man. Luka and his reps need to start putting some pressure on the front office this summer. Hashtag mediocre. I mean, Jason, this kind of speaks to what you were just saying about Luka, and no great player wants to spend their prime years not contending.
Yep. I mean, I don't really have anything to add.
Yeah. Let's go here. Even if Braun takes a pay cut, and this will be the last one, even if Braun takes a pay cut, it's disrespectful to not start him. So no point to try big three next year. For MVP, not hopeful till Rob does his job. Why is Ant 10th, Lakers and Wolves equal in the West standings? Jovan, let's say the math plays out. The Lakers, they make their offseason moves. They spend their money. They have $20 million left. LeBron's still sitting there. They say, hey, LeBron, we got $20 million left. Do you want to be a Laker? Here you go. And LeBron says, okay, he signs up. Is he just automatically in the starting lineup? Is that a good situation for the Lakers, given what we've seen out of the big three so far this year?
I mean, I think he's automatically in the starting lineup. I think if you try to pitch LeBron on both a pay cut and a bench role, that's just not going to fly. And I think he would go elsewhere. So, I mean, he has been adamant that, you know, the big thing for him is like keeping himself mentally engaged in terms of how much longer he wants to play, how much longer he wants to get up at 5 a.m. and do all his training and his recovery and all that stuff. But it's also been... he's maintained that he wants to be playing at like an all-star level, you know, go out on top in terms of like still being a really good player. So I think the second that starts to slip where he's no longer a really good player or like his role potentially gets shifted in that way, that's where I think he would look to either potentially retire or go to a different situation. So I don't see a feasible scenario in which the Lakers keep LeBron and he's not starting and playing a certain amount. I mean, again, like it's technically possible that he could have a change of heart and be like, hey, you're giving me more than the minimum. So like, I'll take the money. I'll come off the bench. I'll accept a smaller role. I just think everything he has said publicly about that and just his status as arguably the best player of all time. I don't like Michael Jordan was never going to accept a bench role. Kobe Bryant was never going to accept a bench role. Mm-hmm. LeBron James, I do not see accepting a bench role. And I agree with Ant. I was shocked that I think Ant was actually 11th, if I'm not mistaken. He was 10th or 11th in the straw poll. I would have had him 6th. With the caveat that like he probably ends up in the top five just because there's a chance that Jokic or Wemby gets eliminated due to games missed. But I think Ant was far too low. Like seeing like a guy like Tyrese Maxey. I like Tyrese Maxey. He's had a great season. He's not better than Anthony Edwards. And the Sixers are not better than the Wolves. So, yeah. I mean, I know they just blew out the Wolves, but it is a 7-game series. I'd still take Minnesota.
I actually think when it comes to the LeBron piece, I think the point you're making about no point in trying the big three, all the stuff we talked about earlier with respect to LeBron needing to do the job remains true, if not even more dramatically next season, right? Because he'd be 42. Mm-hmm. Instead of 41. But like, I don't think LeBron's coming back unless you hit on those other two starters anyway. So like, let's just say for sake of argument, let's say the Lakers pull off a trade for, let's call it Nick Claxton and Tari Eason. And they get Tari Eason in restricted free agency. I'm not saying that those are the players necessarily that I think they'll get. I'm just saying like, let's just say that they get two starters that are like legitimate two-way players at their positions. You get those two guys, then you go to LeBron and you go, hey, this is what we need. I think it makes more sense at that point for him to slot into that role again. Right now, part of why it looks so bad is because it's DeAndre freaking Ayton behind him, and it's a non-starting caliber three that's consistently playing. Like Jake LaRavia was getting fried one-on-one over and over again last night by Jaylen Brown and Peyton Pritchard down the stretch of that game. If you have a limited like hot and cold type of player at the three and a bad center next to starting LeBron at age 41, it's going to look bad. But if it's like a legitimately very good defensive player at the three and a legitimately very good defensive player at the five, I think it makes more sense. And so ultimately what it comes down to for LeBron, I think there's four different places I could see him going: to the Lakers, retiring, to the Cavs, or to the Warriors. And I think what will end up happening is when the season is over, he's either going to feel healthy and playing well and feel like he's got more basketball, or he won't. If he doesn't, he'll retire. But if he feels like he's going to come back and play, he's not going to come back and play for a garbage-ass Lakers team. But if they can hit on some deals this summer and they've got a couple of good supporting players next to him at the 3 and 5, I could see LeBron being like, I stay home. I'm in LA. I'm familiar with the system and these guys. I'll take this job. The Lakers have a little bit of money left over. They pay him. That's great. But if they don't, and if it's still, we might have 4 first-round picks next summer, whatever the hell it is that Rob pitches to us when we get to training camp, I could see LeBron being like, I'd rather go play alongside Evan Mobley and Donovan Mitchell. You know what I'm saying? So, like, I think it'll be one of those things where the universe where LeBron stays with the Lakers involves them having made upgrades, which makes me less worried about his shortcomings in the starting lineup, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I think you're absolutely right. And I also think that I'm going to have to start calling DeAndre Ayton DeAndre freaking Ayton. And he is DA no more. He is now DFA. That is.
Well, in DFA, I mean, in the group chat, we can be a little bit more vulgar about it.
There we go. All right, everybody. I appreciate all the super chats coming in. I will save the ones that we didn't get to. We'll make sure that we get to them. I don't recall off the top of my head, guys. Were we Thursday this week or Friday?
Friday. Well, I mean, Friday. If we want to cover the Thursday night game, we should go Friday.
Yep. Let's go Friday.
Cool.
Let's do Friday then. So we will see everybody on Friday. Thank you all for being here with us. If you haven't done so yet, please make sure you subscribe to the YouTube channel. Follow us over on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts as well. Till next time, everybody. See ya and stay safe.